focus on counseling and psychology and social work, domestic violence prevention, sexual assault prevention. And those things are all fantastic. That's really necessary work. But it has framed the entire conversation around trauma. And so all of this extensive and really impressive hundreds of thousands of years of history of how humans have treated, integrated, and healed traumatic injuries and their impacts has largely been disregarded in that framing. Mm-hmm. And so even our conversation and the way that we think about trauma has been defined by that lens, which is you have to approach it through a healthcare lens, regardless of who you are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that is helpful for people like teachers or other frontline workers. So given that context, when I talk about trauma-responsive education, there's sort of three important things. One is that there are some specific impacts on learning that are closely linked to the impact of trauma on the brain, and it doesn't matter what kind of harm. So there are ways that any kind of trauma is going to impact, because it impacts, there's sort of a broad set of impacts, and then there's a bunch of other stuff that can happen depending on the type mm-hmm. of trauma. So trauma that happens outside of the classroom has impacts on learning that we can work to counter. Doesn't matter what the thing was, but it'll show up in the classroom in particular ways. So the second thing is educational trauma is the harm that happens in classrooms. It is wounds that are inflicted on the soul when people are trying mm-hmm. to learn. So when we're wounded in this way, we become afraid of learning, and our ability to learn may become weaker or more constricted, and we lose confidence in our ability to learn. So when I talk about trauma in education, this is the type of trauma I'm addressing, not what happens elsewhere. And to the best mm-hmm. of my knowledge, I'm the only person who is talking about educational trauma other than the person, Dr. Leanne Gray, who wrote the book Educational Trauma. And there's another person who wrote a different book. They are mainly K-12, and my area of emphasis is with adults. So what is really, I think, useful about this approach is that you don't have to be a healthcare professional to do it. Like, there's no requirement that you understand. I'll talk more about that later, but you don't have to be a healthcare professional. So I want educators, administrators, student services people, anyone who works with other humans who are trying to learn, to understand that there are things that happen during the process of learning that you do have the power and the responsibility to interrupt. And that is sometimes the way that you work with students and sometimes the systemic things that we are mm-hmm. all subject to. And that is difficult because, as we ask all people to think about their positionality and their power and the ways that we all cause harm, the way we all receive harm, it's not easy to admit that we cause harm, even if our intentions are good. And so people get really, it can be very difficult to mm-hmm. say to a teacher, here's what's happening, and this could be harmful because it hurts them. It's very painful. And so that's part of like working with any kind of unhealed trauma, is like working people through that. And so the third thing I think is important, and I touched on it a little bit, is that there's a difference between trauma-informed and trauma-responsive. Mm-hmm. Being trauma-informed is a really good starting point, but it doesn't always give suggestions on how to stop replicating cycles of harm, because it doesn't require a recognition that harm is actually happening or that it happened. It is often also more like an intellectual approach than an approach that is based in reconnecting with our bodies and receiving guidance from what we're feeling. So it's not a wrong approach in any way,
right?
But I think it's limited. And so being trauma responsive, as I have defined it, requires that we recognize in the moment that harm is happening. And that recognition comes from how we are feeling and what our body is telling us about what's happening. And for example, people survive in academia by prioritizing the intellect, and reconnecting with the body can feel really dangerous and really unsafe. And educational trauma, like our own educational trauma, contributes to those feelings. So the way we start to work with that is to understand our own unhealed wounds, like we do in all trauma work. So the trauma responsive principles, which we'll talk about later, offer guidance in how we can hold ourselves in those really hard moments and interrupt those harmful cycles. And until we begin to do those interruptions, until we begin to deal with our own unhealed wounds, like our interruptions are not as effective. They're less interruptions and they're more trying to control and dominate a situation.
This is just sort of a follow-up to that, but I think the way that education is generally set up is that the teacher is controlling everything. You know, the educator is the one who has to tamp down the, the nonconformers. And so, I know there are also things where, people have grown up, well, you're no good at math, or you're not an athlete, or, you're not musical, you can't sing. I mean, these are scars that people, carry forward. And then, of course, when you become an adult, you think that it's too late to change that, that's just cemented in there.
What is cemented is that you can't learn.
Right.
That is the thing that is cemented into people's minds. Or not that you can't learn, but that learning is dangerous. And that if you make a mistake, it doesn't just mean you didn't know something. It doesn't just mean you're trying. It means that you are a bad person. Because that is the way that our system is set up. It's a system of punishment and shame. It is a system of domination and assimilation where people are not... The education is not really, well, I mean, teachers talk about the invisible curriculum, and I think of it as this is the way that we learn how to hurt each other in public. This is one of the unspoken invisible lessons that people take from education is who gets to do the hurting, who has to witness it, and who has to bear it. And we don't talk about that. But I don't think there's a single person I've ever talked to who said, my God, I loved being in school when I was a kid. It was the best experience of my life. I felt so good. I felt so supported. I'm sure there are people who have that experience. But I think everybody that I talked to was like, I escaped. I survived. I made it through. Like, how freaking terrible is that? Like, what a massive... waste of concentrated learning time is
that happens a lot. And then there's comparisons made. Like, I don't know about you, Elizabeth, but they're like, well, you know, your sister, she was this, and your brother was this. So we're just really wondering where you're going to fall somehow in between that. And that was traumatizing because you're always wondering that expectation of being, what do they think about me? And that guilt, blame, shame all over again, but dressed up as somebody in a place of power.
What are some of the things you learned from teaching adult learners overall and in carceral spaces? This part of your teaching career just really fascinates me, truthfully.
So I'll talk about teaching in prisons and jails first, and then I'll talk about just adult learners overall. So first thing is that students in prison classrooms are no different than students in free classrooms. There's no difference in people's wanting to learn, motivated. The circumstances are very different, and it's possible that some people have had very different life experiences, but the soul of the learner and the way that I think about people as learners is no different. And that's, people who are incarcerated are people. And that's just, I mean, that I have to say that because I know that there are so many people who do not believe that or somehow have some twisted idea that they are not people. I know that that's true, but people who are incarcerated are people. And that is the primary that's what's of primary importance to me as an instructor. I don't work with animals. I don't work with the gardens. So the other people who teach those, when they teach in those ways, you know, would be looking for something different. But I'm like, these are people, and you have to adapt to the physical circumstances and environment. You have to understand the culture of the place where you're teaching. Mm-hmm. You have to, there certainly are adjustments that you have to make, but you have to always prioritize that these are human beings, these are people, and they deserve to be treated That's with right. the same amount of dignity that That's everybody right. else should be treated, which, you know, is an issue because we don't treat people with dignity.
Well, we dehumanize anyone who's been incarcerated, and that's why we justify as a society and individually why it is not, it's meant as a punishment. And so, therefore, you know, we can't really think about the individual because that then we're harming a person. And if it's a person, well, wait a minute, are we doing the right thing?
You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to Emmerina Daniels about what it means to have a trauma-responsive educational practice. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation when we come back.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic offers evaluation and follow-up care for children and teens with orthopedic conditions, including sports-related injuries. Care is available regardless of the family's ability to pay. Details about the Vancouver Clinic are at shriners.org/Vancouver Clinic.
KXRW is supported by The Columbian, which provides coverage of environmental, transportation, and homelessness issues of vital interest to the region and is made possible through its community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation. Available at columbian.com.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Emmerina Daniels, an author, educator, and scholar. Our conversation with them continues.
Something I think is important to emphasize is that people are dehumanized long before they are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So that dehumanization usually begins in school. The population of people who are incarcerated, which is heavily discriminatory towards Black people, brown people, people with disabilities, and people who are poor, those people are dehumanized long before they Right. are incarcerated. So incarceration is just the extreme Mm-hmm. form of that dehumanization. I've been in this field for a long, long time, and I'm going to say that people who have not ever taught in I say prison. Jails are different. Youth facilities are different. Mm-hmm. They have similar cultures, but just because of the nature of jails is like short term, have some similarities to adult facilities, but not. But nobody who has never taught in there or who has spent a significant amount of time believes when I tell them how bad it is. They don't believe people who have been incarcerated and come out and tell their stories.
No, they don't.
They don't believe them. Sometimes people are able to break through, like Dr. Stanley Andreese, who wrote From Prison Cells to PhDs. Mm-hmm. Like that work has been able to break through. There have been other people who have broken through, the people who run Civil Survival. There was an elected representative in our state who was formerly incarcerated, first formerly incarcerated person. Tara Simmons, I think, in the country who was elected. People do not want to believe how truly horrific prisons are. The only reason that ICE is able to operate as it is, the only reason that these concentration camps and detention centers are being mm-hmm. put up is because the infrastructure and the culture are in the ecosystem are all already in place because of mass incarceration.
Absolutely true.
Yes. There's a direct connection there. And we have let mass incarceration, which is the extension of slavery, we have allowed that to become one of our economic, so deeply embedded in our economic system that to remove prisons from the system of economics and politics in this country would be crippling.
Oh,
not saying it shouldn't be.
All that free labor.
All the free labor, the way that where prisons are located is also politically is mm-hmm. there's a process called political gerrymanderings, and the way that states count where people are held instead of where they're supposed to be counted. So it's a whole thing. I think we could do a whole show on that. I feel like I'm going to bring myself back. I'm going to bring myself back.
Although that was pretty powerful.
Yeah. It is. Oh, yeah. And this is only the first point, which is that people who are incarcerated are people.
Right.
And so the second point I would say back to the question, which was, what are the things that I've learned, is that people should not have to go to prison to get an education.
No.
They should not have to go to prison to get a GED, which is basically nothing.
Right.
It doesn't count for Mm-mm. much. Even a high school diploma these days doesn't count for much, let alone a GED. But they should not have to go to prison to get a high school credential. They shouldn't have to go to prison to get a college degree. I mean, I think that college should be free for everyone. And if we're willing to give, the ICE $85 billion, and now, you know, we're coming back and asking for $200 billion for war. I'm like, never tell me again that we can't afford to make college free for everybody.
Exactly.
Do you know how hard I'm having to work not to swear right now?
Oh.
Just going to say.
Don't worry. We got to worry about Elizabeth.
Yeah. Okay. So people should not have to go to prison. Third, education as it is today and prison are much more aligned than people want to admit or even realize. And educational trauma is a major contributing factor in why people appear to give up on themselves. So if you've literally been harmed into believing that you can't learn, which means you can't change, why would you even try? And if trying only leads you to more punishment and shame, everybody would give up. Anybody would give up.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And that people are willing to try even after all of the harm that has been inflicted on them, mm-hmm. that they've suffered during education, is a miracle of courage. And that they are willing to try in an environment that is actively and physically hostile to learning is an act of incredible bravery. And I can't say that enough times. You know, I don't care what corrections officials and whatever say about this and that. That culture of corrections is directly in opposition to a culture of learning, and
That's
it is
right.
actively and physically hostile to that. So people have to be very careful about how they express their learning and how they change and how they express how they're changing. They have to be very careful about that because it can be dangerous for them, and that they are still willing to do it mm-hmm. is freaking amazing.
It makes me very sad to hear that, to imagine that. But I also feel the hope that you're saying that there are people who are still going to try in spite of all of those terrible things that have happened to them. And, you know, it just, I don't know, it makes me sad how we treat people, you know, overall, and mm-hmm. that we accept it and we don't question it. So I'm very happy that you're reminding us
That's
people
right.
who are incarcerated are people. They're human beings. They're individuals. They're not all some one size fits all villain, you know?
No. Mm.
They're moms, they're dads, they're sons and daughters, you know, they're parents.
They are, but I mean, even beside that, even without defining them and their relationship to a family, mm-hmm. they're still a human being. And this, you know, comes back to the idea, like, we talk a lot about how we think life is precious, and mm-hmm. none of our actions prove that to be true.
That's absolutely true.
And we'll say this largely as a society, as a larger culture, broadly as a species. That doesn't mean individual people cannot think life is precious and cannot be working towards life and toward protecting all of life, the planet, children,
yes,
adults, however that is. But broadly, in the larger context, it does not seem that we care about life in the way mm-hmm. that we say that we do. I don't know that anybody, I don't know what evidence would exist to the contrary for that. I mean, just in this country alone, and then when you look at what happens in other countries, I mean, there's a very tiny amount of life, and I'm air quoting that, that apparently is important enough to protect. And I just have to think that even those people don't care about their own lives. Not really. Because if you care about your own life, if you really believe that life is precious and that your life is important and meaningful, you would never inflict the kind of harm on another person that so many people are inflicting.
Absolutely.
You just don't do that. It just doesn't happen. If you're somebody who really believes that life is precious and you care about yourself, mm-hmm. and you care about, you know, preserving this planet, and you care about the future of humans as a viable species that's not just on a death march to nuclear winter, you don't treat other people the way that we are watching people be treated.
No. No, I agree 100%. You are speaking our language.
Yep.
You are speaking it. And I do believe, but there are people out there that truly care about the hurt and harm. Not just about themselves, they're willing to sacrifice. And history has proven over and over again for those that were willing to give up their own lives to protect us. And we owe it. Mm-hmm. We owe it to their memory to continue to stay in the good fight, to care, and to not allow the circumstances and the chaos going around us to impede our progress. We are the hope. When somebody says, I feel hopeless. If that was the case, then why show up? If that's how you truly feel, we're the people that they've been waiting for. We showed up. Thing is, we got to continue to go. We got to see it to the end. We cannot give up.
Right.
We can't let that go. So thank you for speaking boldly, courageously, and strong towards something that most people kind of look and say, well, you know, I'm okay. You're not okay when we're not all okay. You'll never be okay.
That is really the truth of it. And I think people, I mean, we've forgotten how interdependent we are.
Yes.
And we've forgotten, like, there's a biology at work, too. It's not just our culture. It's not just the way that our brains think. It's not just the society that we developed. Like, biologically, our bodies need to be around other bodies. And if we want our bodies to feel good in themselves, then we need other people to also feel good. And that means people need to have enough food. People need to not feel like they're being hunted if they walk outside of their homes. People need to feel like they're going to be okay if they get in their car and drive and they're not going to just get shot down in the street. Like, we need people to have housing. We need to look at what is it that, you know, pushes people toward different types of addiction, for example, like different types of ways that they want to disconnect because their reality just feels so bleak and abysmal. Like, there have to be ways that we can connect with people. And, you know, connections become like such a buzzword, like community has become such a buzzword, and we need community, all this stuff. And I'm like, it's time. And this is back to, like, I think education, which is like, we have this whole time in our lives that was dedicated to us learning, but we didn't learn these things. We didn't really learn what it meant to take care of each other in a public space.
Right.
We didn't really learn what it meant for adults to care for children, like, in a public space. Like, what does that mean in public? It doesn't mean that you don't care about, you know, you don't want somebody to, there's a difference between actively caring and just not wanting a bad thing to happen to someone. And I think that, you know, we don't necessarily learn that. You're like, well, I don't want anything bad to happen. I'm like, all right, well, what are we doing? What in our life, maybe it's a tiny thing, but what can you do around that? So
we don't want to be bystanders.
I think not. Because
if you're just witness bystanders without any action or, you know, so it's very difficult not to be a bystander, to actually do something, take an action, take a position. You know, it's very hard with family that doesn't agree with you, say, politically or socially. It's very hard when people think you're weak or naive because you're caring. You know, they don't, they misconstrue what your motivation is, because they don't want to feel it themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so many people are shut down, and then, you know, I at one point I felt paralyzed by my empathy, because I felt so much pain. If I saw someone, you know, on the sidewalk and, you know, obviously sick or, you know, drugged or, you know, hurting or just exhausted, I couldn't bear it, because I didn't actually think of anything that I could do. You know, I didn't have that next step of, like, I would feel it and I'd be like, oh, I can't see this. I just can't see it. I see a lot of people doing that right now. I can't listen to the news. I can't do this. I can't read the paper. I don't want to think about that. And I get it. I get it. You know, if you are a decent human being, all these terrible things happening are very hurtful. So take the next step. You know, that's the thing. Do something about it. Some little thing. You don't have to save the world. You can do one thing. For information about Emerina Daniel's work, podcast, and educational services, please visit their website, meoutloud.com.
You've been listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. That concludes part one of our interview with Emerina Daniels, an author, educator, and podcaster. Part two will broadcast in 2 weeks.
X-Ray FM would like listeners to know about a local nonprofit, Birch Community Services, that's providing food and financial education for working, struggling families. Whether through jobs that don't provide livable wages or a cloud of debt, these families are at risk for food insecurity and long-term stagnation. That's where Birch comes in, providing groceries, financial education, and one-on-one financial counseling in a caring and nurturing environment. Join Birch in building financially stable families in the Portland area. More information at birchcommunityservices.org.
You're listening to Street Roots Radio. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots Radio is a collaboration between X-Ray FM, KBOO Radio, and local publication Street Roots. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. Today, the article we are discussing is called "The Heat Is On: Projection for a Hot Summer Spells Danger for Homeless Portlanders Amid Service Cuts and Increased Sweeps." I have with me Street Roots' new investigative reporter, Henry Brennan, who wrote this article. Thanks for being here, Henry.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're new to Street Roots, and I'd love to introduce you to our listeners. If you could just tell us a little bit about how you started reporting first, what topics you tend to focus on, and what brought you to Street Roots.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of a homecoming in a way. I'm from Portland, and when I wanted to start reporting, I actually reached out to Street Roots about a decade ago to volunteer at the front desk. And then, yeah, you know, years later, when I did my first official pitch, it was actually also for Street Roots. So I was kind of schooled by Street Roots. And then from there, you know, I went on to work for the PBS NewsHour as a fellow there, producing some stories and helping out. And then covered rural health in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley for a couple NPR stations. And then ended up coming back to this area. I worked for the Columbian and the Daily News through Washington's state-funded journalism program. It's called the Murrow News Fellowship. And there I covered the Columbia River. But now coming back to Street Roots, this time, you know, not as a freelancer, official style. Very, very exciting. You know, I think Street Roots I love it. You know, it's done a lot for me, and I think I really believe it's the best place in the region to get news when you really want to understand stuff. As far as what I plan to cover, I've kind of got this little system I'm thinking for what I want to do.